we are in Ezra 4:1-24, as we're talking about the building of the temple after the people of Judah and Benjamin have been taken off into exile because of their sin, because of their disobedience towards God. They spent 70 years in exile in another land. They were displaced from their home. They were, in a sense, like refugees, and now they are returning to their home and with a task and a plan that God has given them for their work that they are to do. A few years ago, when I was a youth or a pastor in a different community, we lived in a neighborhood in which a family was building a house. It was just down the street from us. And they poured the foundation and they built the concrete walls, and the structure was framed and the roof was on it. I don't think they had finished putting the shingles on it. And then all of a sudden, all the construction stopped. And in order to understand what was going on, I have to give you a little bit of context about building, if you're not familiar with how building works. But what happened was is that when you build a house, it has to fit on a piece of land. And it has to fit in a certain place on that piece of land, and it cannot be too far forward or too far backwards from the street, for instance. And if you do that wrong, you're in trouble. Well, what happened here was that they had placed the house in the wrong place. And so what they ended up having to do was take the whole house, lift it off of its basement, move it to the side, demolish the basement, demolish the foundation, and re-pour the whole thing. I think they had to move it back 3 feet or something like that. And then they moved the house back on. Can you just imagine the cost that they had to do that and the discouragement that they went through in order to have that done? Well, as we continue in our study of Ezra, we have seen the building of the temple where they laid the foundation of the temple. But as we study chapter 4, we see a major setback that leads to the construction stopping. And I think that as we look at this, as we study this, I think we're going to see some dramatic parallels to our day to day and how we might apply that to ourselves. And so we want today to look at the message of Ezra chapter 4, and then we want to look at some ways that we can apply this to our lives. So Ezra chapter 4 verse 1 says that the adversaries, the enemies of Judah and Benjamin, they heard that they were rebuilding the temple. This probably comes through reports, but I can't help but think back to chapter 3, verse 13, where it says that after they had laid the foundations of the temple, they celebrated. They threw this gigantic party, and it was so huge that it could be heard all through the countryside. And maybe that's how they heard of it. We're not sure, but for whatever reason and in whatever way, they had heard about this rebuilding, and their enemies then came against them. We see that in this in verse 1. And these enemies came, and these are people that are not Israelites. These are people that have been moved there by the king of Assyria, and they're living in the land. And they go to Zerubbabel, who is the prince, or he is like the governor of that at that time. And they go to the household leaders, and they offer to assist them in their rebuilding. Let us help you rebuild the temple. We see that in verse 2. And their offer comes as they claim that they are worshipers of Yahweh and have done so since being brought to the land. Well, then in verse 3, it tells us that the leaders of Judah refuse their offer to help, and they contend that they should have nothing to do with these people. They should be doing it on their own. They are the ones that are supposed to build their house to God. He says, they're not part of us. And this is our job to do. They didn't see them as part of this same community. They did not see that the command that was given by the king to rebuild included these other people. It was their task alone to do. Now, we might wonder, why wouldn't you accept help from someone that wanted to give you aid? Because this is a very large job to do. Well, we see the answer in 2 Kings. 2 Kings chapter 17, verses 24 to 33. And there we find that the king of Assyria placed these people in Israel, but they did not worship and fear God. And so what happened was, is that God sent lions, wild beasts, to them to torment them and even kill some of them. And the king of Assyria recognized this was from God because they were not worshiping him. And he tries to solve the issue by sending Israelite priests. Now, these are priests that have been displaced and they're living in Babylon or other places. And he brings them back to teach these people that are not Jews to fear the Lord. Now, this wasn't some kind of ancient evangelism effort because they did not know the law. They did not follow the law of God. They worshiped gods of Babylon and other nations. They were and operated as people that we call syncretists. And what a syncretist is someone who blends their religion with the worship of the one true God, and God considers that to be an abomination. It's a terrible, terrible thing. In fact, the reason why the Jews were displaced from their land and taken into exile is because they were doing that very thing. And so these are not true worshipers of God. They are people that did not have the convictions of a follower of God. So in order to build God's house, to restore worship among them, it has to be built by God's people. Then in verses 6 to 16, these enemies take action to oppose them. The people find out that their offer of help is not really genuine. These enemies start by trying to pressure them to stop through different discouraging means. And this idea of discouragement that's in our text means to make your hand weak, to take all the strength from you, to drain it out of your soul and out of your body. They wanted these Jews to lose enthusiasm and lose their will to build. They used intimidation and other means. They threatened them in some way. They went to counselors and so forth who are Persian officials, and they worked for the king and bribed them, trying to maybe create some kind of bureaucratic stumbling block to them. And they used all of these tactics from the time that Cyrus was king all the way up to the time in which Darius the First is king. So it lasted, this portion of their torment and of their opposition, it lasted from 8 to 10 years. When King Artaxerxes is made king, they send him a letter, these opposers. Then the letter seems to describe the opposition to rebuilding the city, but Ezra is using it here in the context of the temple. And they accuse the Jews of being rebellious and wicked. So they had all kinds of inflammatory rhetoric, all kinds of name-calling and so on. And they speculate, these opposers to the work of God, that if the Jews regain power, if they can rebuild their city and rebuild their temple and restore their lives, that they will rebel. And so they appeal to the king by saying, you know what, if they do this, they're not going to want to pay you the taxes anymore. And they might want to actually get their land back, and you no longer will have power over it. So they appeal to him and his love of money and his love of power. They also pander to the king's ego by expressing their loyalty to them when they say that they eat the salt of the palace. That was a way of saying that they're loyal to him. It describes part of their motive, and their motive wasn't pure. And then they back up their accusations by encouraging the king to look in the records. And what they say to them is, what you're going to find, that if you look back in the records of the kings, is that these people were rebellious, they did not listen, they didn't follow, and that's what they will find. They'll find that Hezekiah and Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Assyria, and that's why they were taken into captivity and deported out of the land. Then in verses 17 to 22, the king sends back a letter ordering the Jews to stop the rebuilding. The king obviously has agreed with the Jewish enemies. He searches the records and he finds that what they're saying is true. So even if the other things that they say are not quite true or misguided, this adds weight to their claim when when he does find truth in it. And he orders the rebuilding to stop because he saw that it was going to damage his interests. The letter is then taken to the Jews in verses 23 and 24, and they are forced to stop the rebuilding. They very quickly present this letter to the Jews. They now have the power of the Persian Empire behind them. And when it says that they were forced to stop rebuilding, we can maybe take this in one of two ways. That the letter itself was force enough to get them. So they would wave this letter in their face and they'd take a look at it and say, and read through it and go, yeah, sure enough, he's told us we have to stop. So then they order all of the people who are rebuilding, yeah, we got to stop. The king says we can't do it anymore. Or what might have happened is that they showed the letter that was displaying the will of the king, but they didn't listen. They continued to work and they had to be stopped by force. There are some ancient histories, one by Josephus, that records that the enemies of the Jews went with cavalry. They went with mounted horsemen and armed troops to hinder the builders and then finally stopping the rebuilding of the temple. Now, we can't be sure what is accurate, but what we do know is that the rebuilding of the worship and the restoration of God's people together lasted 15 or 16 years. Now, when we turn to the application of this text, there can be many things that we could say. There's lots of things that we could go through that would be applicable to our lives, but I want to focus on three particular things. The first is this, is that God's restoration will not be trouble-free. God's restoration will not be trouble-free. At the end of chapter 3, the foundation has been laid, the temple has begun to be rebuilt, they celebrate this achievement. But all of this is very short-lived. They had this mountain peak experience, this moment, and now, with this opposition, they're living in the dark shadows of this valley. And it would be an error for us to think that when God directs our paths, directed their paths, that those paths are not going to have opposition. If we're traveling a road, there is going to be rocks and there's going to be roots. There's going to be problems. There might be robbers along the way. There might be restrictions along the way. Moses himself encountered this. He's called to lead the people of Israel out of captivity, out of slavery in Egypt. And along the way, Pharaoh pursues them. They come to the Red Sea and God has to part the sea because it stood in their way of getting free of the Pharaoh's army. They were wandering in the wilderness and they didn't have food or water, and God had to supply water from rocks and manna from the heavens. We see all of these things. And then they enter the hostile land and these nations are against them. And they had to find their way past them and defeat them. It would be a mistake to assume that just because everything is not going well, that everything is not smooth sailing, that somehow we're not following God or we have misunderstood Him. Paul, he did not consider his imprisonment as a confirmation that he misunderstood God's calling for him to preach the gospel. Martin Luther in the Reformation, when he stood before the council at the Diet of Worms and he was being told to recant everything he believed, he didn't consider that God's voice telling him, oh, I must be wrong, I need to stop. Just because there is opposition does not mean that we are to end. Do we ever think that when God calls us to put off sin, to stop sinning, that it will somehow be trouble-free and easy? When we engage in our sin, when we enjoy our sin, that's when we find moments of easiness because we're not fighting. But when we fight against our sin, when we fight against possibly that problem with bad language, or we fight against that habit that we have, sin is going to fight back. Sin does not want to give in. It is going to fight all the more. So God calls His people to restore worship and the glory of His name to rebuilding His church. And if we don't face trouble, if everything goes easy, I would be alarmed at that. If we're doing what is right, if we're doing what God calls us to do, there will be opposition. That is a guarantee. There will be affliction. And the last thing that we should conclude is that we have misread God. In fact, Jesus said so in John chapter 16, verse 33. In the world, you will have tribulation, he tells us. But take heart, I have overcome the world. Restoration is God's call for us to pursue the victory that Christ has already won by his work upon the cross. But it will not come without trouble. So we see that God's restoration will not be trouble-free. And secondly, what we learn, what we can apply here, is something very closely related, is that God's restoration will come with opposition. Three things that we can count on as we do the work of fighting for us to be the church together and for restoration of worship. We can count on sin, we can count on Satan, and we can count on the world. And these three things are our enemies. The sin is the constant condition of our own hearts, fighting against our desire to seek after God. Satan is that angel of death that has from the beginning tried to oppose dependence upon God. He has opposed faithfulness to God. He has opposed the atonement of Christ. He has opposed true worship. And then there is this world with all of its evil, pagan system that controls every level of value, worldview, and ideology and infects and controls every heart that does not seek after God. As we study Ezra and we connect it to the book of Haggai, and we're going to do that next week, sin in the hearts of those called to bring restoration of worship rises up within them, and they have all these things that are hindering them because of their sin. And I have no doubt that Satan is very active trying to create stumbling blocks of trouble and discouragement and temptation in their path. And we see here in Ezra chapter 4 that they faced opposition from the world. And we learn some things as we read this passage about that opposition. We learn that that opposition comes from people that claimed to be their allies. It's fascinating that while he says that they have come to offer help, he gives us a kind of hint even before that by calling them their adversaries or their enemies. And he plays his hand. He lets us know that something is wrong here. It is kind of like going to a market where they allow bartering and negotiation for a price. And the person who's trying to sell you the goods says to you, you know what, I really like you. You're a great person. I want to give you a special deal I give no one else. Well, we know they're not being honest. You know that they're just trying to win you over so you'll take their special price. Their interest is not in you. Their interest is in themselves. And particularly, these people that were opposing the people of God were people who claimed to worship God, but they had aligned themselves with this world. Now, there are people who are going to be in what we might call our inner circle. They come from within. These can be people that are attending our church but don't trust Jesus as their Savior. They can be people who are compromised by believers, who are compromised by sin and Satan in the world. And when we partner with things in terms of asking people to be in leadership or asking people to serve, we can't have people who don't love Jesus leading and serving in the church. We have to monitor. We also have to monitor those who may be compromised in their faith. Now, all of us, in one sense and the other, because we are sinful people, are compromised. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about those who choose not to follow the Bible, who act more according to their feelings than according to truth, who live by a very worldly, secular perspective in their thinking. We cannot have these people in areas of leadership until God changes their heart. Now, sometimes there are people who are outside of our church, and I mean specifically they can be another church, or it can be another organization, a parachurch organization that may want to partner with us in something. There are plenty of organizations that would love to guide us and to take money from us for a fee and to help with conducting our worship or learning how to do that better or how to do outreach or to start a building program or to organize our leadership. But I've looked at many of them, and many of them are good, but there are a number who are very misguided in their direction and what they desire to do, and we do not follow them if they do not follow God's word. So we need to be careful. And the same goes with other churches. Sometimes we presume that because a church down the street or across the city says they love the Lord, it doesn't mean that we have the same values or we believe the same things, and we have to be careful. I found this out when I was in my last pastor position, and what we would do as ministers of the church, of the churches in that community, we would meet together regularly, and one of the things that we did is we planned a vacation Bible school. And we would, in this community, do a community-wide Bible school where there would be maybe 200-300 children that would come to this, and it was good in many respects. But one of the things that we were talking about at one point is who should be teaching the Bible lessons. And I thought it was very important that it needed to be someone who we knew was a believer in Jesus Christ, who had been given some instruction on how to teach, and who understood the gospel. I think any of us would consider that to be just the normal things that we'd presume. While at the same time, another one of the ministers spoke up, and he says, you know what, I don't think that's important. I think that it would be perfectly fine to have a non-Christian, an unbeliever, teach the Bible lesson. An unbeliever can share the gospel just as well as we can. And I was horrified. I normally at these meetings tried to keep my mouth closed and not speak up, but this was an occasion where I could hardly hold back. And thankfully, this person didn't get their way. But I knew from that moment on, we can't partner with this church on things because we think very differently about how God operates and what he expects of us. And it's unfortunate. So we must understand that one of the things we learn from this opposition is that we can't always align ourselves with other people, even if they claim to be aligned with us. Then I see that we need to understand that this opposition can be tenaciously persistent. Judah's enemies did not give up. They tried to hinder them for a long time. They spent years doing it. And we cannot count them on them to give up. The evil convictions in a person are strong, and they're driven by forces that have, at times in our history, rivaled the faith of Christians. You look right now at opposition to the Christian faith in China. It is resurging. It is growing. It is increasing. I look at our COVID virus as an opposition. It is an enemy that has not gone away, and I think we're naive if we think it ever will. In fact, it's fighting back with variants that we can't seemingly control. And these are very real oppositions. I see the restrictions on gathered worship as opposition. Now, do I think that we are opposed because we are hated? Do I believe that we are targeted for Christian persecution, or we are seen as a threat to their lives and their beliefs? I don't think that. But this is the raw fact of the matter. The actions that are being taken in the restrictions on our worship, whether we think they're right or wrong, whether we think they're necessary or not, is really not the issue. It really doesn't matter. Regardless of all these things, the net result is that our worship is hindered because of it. A third thing that we learn under this second application is that opposition will not engage us with integrity. The opponents of the Jews' restoration of worship, they were willing to do whatever it took to oppose them. These authorities were cruel. They were calling names. They were coming up with lies. They were using past sins and mistakes against them. This is what they're going to do. They're going to make accusations that are not true. And I see this as I occasionally read articles about how the church is trying to operate during this time and how they're trying to continue to meet and all those things. And I read an article like that, and then I go down to the comment section in those articles, and I end up reading inevitably about someone who is saying, oh yeah, the church, the only reason that they want to gather together is they want the people's money. That's all they're really interested in. They're not interested in them. They just want more money. And they know that if the people don't come, they're not going to get their money. Or I read another comment where they say, oh yeah, that Christian faith is all a belief in myths and things like that. It's just a crutch for their lives because they can't handle things. You know, it's just them trying to control people. It's just a cult. These are terrible accusations, which are not true. They may, in some cases, be half-truths. Sometimes they can be things in which a church has no longer practicing. Maybe they've corrected themselves, but it doesn't matter. They're still going to make the accusation against them. So in our church, why do we fight for restoration of our church to worship together in person? Why do we go through that? Why do we battle that? I think it is because we truly care for your relationship with Christ. And the longer that we are not restored, the more that we suffer. Now, I've heard it said, even among people of our own church, that the lack of gathering has not in any way caused them any suffering. They're doing perfectly fine. The alternatives are just as good as meeting together and gathering together. And I have trouble with that. Because as I search the scriptures, I see from the beginning to the end, even right here in the book of Ezra, the gathering of God's people is the means by which God grows us and brings us closer to Himself. And if we think that we are not suffering by being apart, it is no different than having a hidden cancer that we don't know about. That we may feel okay, but in fact, it's really killing us. And that's a serious matter. But what these Jewish opponents also used was sympathetic weapons. They used the king, the government, to their ends. Do you think for a moment that Artaxerxes cared about anything about these people? Do you think he had any concern for the Jews? He probably didn't even think about them twice. No concern at all. But when they presented to him something that interested him, something that was important to him, now that all changed. They appealed to the things that were important to him, to money and to power. And when we think about our days and our government is acting by its values, it's acting by its priorities. It does not matter if we think what they are doing is right or wrong. It doesn't matter whether we think that it's necessary or not. They really are not concerned about us. In fact, I would say that the government is neither against us nor for us. They're kind of apathetic towards us. They see us as nothing more different or anything different than a social club. And so they treat us as such. They are attempting to act for the safety and security of their citizens, to their interest, to the economic benefits that come from making the decisions that they make. And as a consequence, not deliberately, we are hindered from restoring our worship because they're simply doing what is in their best interest. We must understand that. So we see that, first of all, we can apply this by understanding that restoration is never going to be trouble-free. Secondly, we need to understand that this restoration is not going to come without opposition. And then I think that we must understand that God's restoration should elicit from us a proper response. Now, I can name many things that I would not stand for, that I would not die for, that I would not enter the fires a martyrdom for. Probably one of them would be that I probably wouldn't die for my mode of baptism preference. Probably wouldn't die for that. I could think of some things in terms of my end time and future theology that I wouldn't you know, die for. There's some of that that I wouldn't do, but there's some things I would. And I'm fairly convinced. And we see this around the world in places like China. We see things like this in places like Indonesia. We see things like this in North Korea, where people are willing to suffer and even die for the sake of gathering as God's people. And I think we should as well. We see that for about 10 years, the Jews did not give in to the opposition. They continued to restore the church. And it doesn't say that they complained. It hints that they were discouraged and frustrated. At least that was the intentions of their enemies. But they stuck to the fact that God commanded them to rebuild the house of God as Cyrus was led to do. And as we see the work of restoration hindered, we see it being accomplished even in this last week. Last week, a week ago, I stood up here in front of you as we, in a sense, kind of celebrated the fact that God was working to restore and moving forward. We met with nearly 200 people. And in a matter of a week, we're reduced down to where we can only meet with 50 people at a time. And the question that we can ask ourselves, are we going to fall back or are we going to fight forward? Now this week, I admit to you, I was ready to give up. It was not a good week. I thought what we should do is just return to the way we worshiped last April, where everything was on video. And I thought that's maybe just the thing we should do. But then we met with our elders and our deacons and our other pastors, and we discussed the issue and we talked about it. And we came up with a plan that we're trying to implement now. And I was reminded that we need to keep fighting to meet together. So we see these Jewish people continue, despite the opposition, until there was no room to do so. They did not give up to the rabble-rousers. They didn't concede to intimidation. They didn't give in to fear. And it took an order of the king and an army to force them to stop. Now, as I said, we've been reduced. We've been reduced to 25% or 50 people. And they have now mandated mass for singing. And yet, we should fight on. Because we can still hold multiple services. We can still have Bible studies. We can still have community groups meeting. We can still have youth groups meeting. And as much as I'm troubled by such things as wearing a mask for worship, my vocal cords are not cut by the mask. So I can still, even though my voice is muffled, I can still sing, and God, who has divine ears, can still hear me. I want to make it clear, I hate this. I hate it. But we carry on. We fight forward. And if they shut us down completely, which could happen, we'll record our services and we'll worship from home and we'll keep fighting forward. And if the day comes in the months or years or decades when we face the kind of persecution that's happening in other places in the world, if they take everything from us, if they take even what we're doing here today from us, then we will meet in secret. And we will sing loudly in our hearts because the gates of hell cannot prevail against the church. So the stopping of restoration is only a pause in God's plan. As I said, we're going to look at chapter 5 next week and we're going to bring in the book of Haggai and we're going to see that by God's providence, the full restoration of worship and the rebuilding of the temple resumes. We should anticipate that the outcome of this pandemic is that we will resume the building. But even if these restrictions on our worship would continue for decades, if they become normal, this is still only a pause in our restoration. In years to come, our nation, I am fully convinced, the writing is on the wall, the signs are everywhere, that there will come a day in our nation that we will resemble places where there is religious oppression, like we find in other nations, where perhaps on this day a church is meeting peacefully. They are in secret. And people have been at, and authorities are at the door, and they knock it down, and they take away their leaders, and they disband that church. And you know what those people are doing? They're already planning of the next place that they're going to meet together in secret and do it all over again. Because they will not give up. And our future holds that one day, perhaps before Christ returns, you or I will die, and then we will enter the presence of our God. And then that place of light and splendor, we will experience restoration, and we will sing the praises of Christ with the likes of Abraham and Paul and Luther and Billy Graham and my grandmother, and we will not be stopped. And a day will come when Christ will return. And we will be with him as he makes the new heavens and the new earth. And we will have our restoration, and we will partake in the wedding feast of the Lamb, and we will sing, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come," and nothing will oppose our worship ever again. When I received the news of the restriction changes this week, it was like someone knocked the breath out of me. I remember a time in my childhood where I was walking on this fence. Someone dared me to walk on a fence, and I fell and landed on it. And for that, have you had that happen where you just can't breathe? It's all knocked out of you? It's the most horrible, horrible feeling. I lost every ounce of desire to keep trying, and I said to myself at the time, "I give up. They win." That afternoon, I was doing some exercising, and then I stopped at one moment, and I prayed, and I cried, because I did not know how to carry on. I did not know how to lead myself. I did not know how to lead my family. I did not know how to lead this church. And I thought to myself, I need to be the shepherd of the flock that God has put under my care, and I can't even lead myself. And I cried out again for God's grace and for his mercy. In addition to that, what has been equally distressing is that over the past days, my heart has been broken because people have said to me, "I don't know if I can go on. This is devastating." And then as much as it's great that in a matter of, what was it? It was 3 hours it took for both of our services this morning to be filled. But there's people that could not come. People who could not come with their whole families. And that just breaks my heart that we cannot all be together. But the Spirit of God is still working as he fills us with holy desire to proclaim along with David that there is nothing better than to be in the house of the Lord and to keep fighting for that. And it may be kind of a backhanded encouragement. I don't know if you would take it that way. But if our hearts are broken over not being able to meet together, that is really, really good. That is really good. It reminds us of how important it is and how important it should be in our lives. But what maybe causes me even more anguish and more distress and more tears is that there's people in churches, and perhaps even ours, in our church, who consider the changes and having to adapt to them as little consequence, of little meaning to their lives. They don't see it as any greater of a change than changing the brand of toothpaste they use. And that is very, very sad. Now, I trust that our study of Ezra is timely, that it is by God's providence, and that we can find comfort for our souls and strength for our will, that our affliction, as we read here in Ezra and other places and know of people and occasions, that our affliction is no greater than others have ever faced before. And yet history tells us that God did not abandon his rebuilding plans. He restored them, and he will one day restore us. And if this time of our life persists, those of us who suffer will be given grace. But we will not be defeated. We will lament our loss, but we will seek God for ways to glorify Him together as one body until He sets in place what is needed for our full restoration. But in these moments, I want to leave you with some counsel. I would say this: turn in your hour of need to prayer and pour out your lament to God. He is the best listener I know, and He speaks through the still small voice of peace in the soul, even as those waves are crashing about you. Turn to the Bible and read it. Read the Psalms and see how the psalmist laments and cries out to God and finds hope in God's steadfast love. Read 1 Peter and see that His guidance is there in the midst of a people who are suffering. Turn to your church. We can still gather in smaller groups. We can still come together for Bible studies. We can still join with each other in prayer. We still have a service that is going to take place on Saturday where we're going to record it. And then on Sunday, we have two viewings of the recordings. And I would say, come. Come if you can. And you might say, well, what benefit is there to gathering together to just view the service on a screen? I can do that from home in my pajamas. Well, yes, you can. But you will miss out on the corporate singing of God's people together in one place, the fellowship and the encouragement of the body together in one place, even if it is not all live. Turn to serving one another. One of the greatest benefits of service is that it gets your thoughts and eyes off yourself and your own afflictions and puts your thoughts and pursuits on the care of others. Reach out with care for one another. I would suggest start calling up people and praying for them. Go through our directory and send people notes of encouragement in the mail. Pick a family once a week or every 2 weeks and offer to bring them a meal of encouragement. Call someone from the church and meet up for a walk in the park. All of these things can be helpful so that we stay connected and we stay close and we can encourage each other through this trying time. And then I would encourage you, turn to a passage like 1 Peter chapter 4, 12 to 19. Please turn there for a moment. We're going to read that. 1 Peter chapter 4, 12 to 19. Take courage from a passage like this, where it says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when His glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." Let us pray.